Listener production.
Hello, welcome to the Weekend Briefing. This interview gets into the space that, even though we don't admit it, it consumes a lot of our thinking, which is, how do I survive financially but doing a job that I actually like and a job that doesn't consume the rest of my life? Like, this is one of the most important problems you have to solve, particularly in your 20s. But I think this challenge really never ends, wherever you're at in your life stage. And my guest, Tim Duggan, he spent a lot of time thinking about this and he's written a book called Work Backwards. And as we're about to explore, Tim brings a really interesting personal story to this book. He was the founder of Junkie Media. He founded that in 2013. You might have heard of it. It's a youth and pop culture media outlet similar to Pedestrian. Now, within 4 years, he managed to build that business and then sell it for around $15 million. And that's partly what gave him the freedom to stop and think about how to make work suit our lives rather than the other way around. It also gives him really sharp insights into the big fight happening between Meta and Australian news media right now. Tim Duggan, welcome to the Weekend Briefing.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So before we get your advice for our lives about how we navigate work, money and life, let's find out a bit more about yours because you've got a really interesting story, your career story. Tell us about it.
I never know what to call myself. I think that's kind of from a young age. I've never quite known whether I am the ultimate slashy who's done lots of different things. And I started straight out of school and realized, I think at a young age, that I didn't just want to jump on the bandwagon of, you know, I came from a private school in Sydney. Mm-hmm. Everyone just went straight to a university, studied commerce or studied law or studied arts or something that just, you know, the parents told them to do or society told them to do. And so from a young age, I realized I didn't want to do that. So I was the first person, I'm the youngest of four, the first person in my family to say, I don't want to go to university straight away. And that was quite a difficult thing.
People are often bragging about the other way around, aren't they? The first in their family to go to university or the first not to?
I like that. Yeah, I was the first, I think, to kind of break with convention. And instead, I looked around and figured out what I liked. And for me, this whole world of marketing and advertising was really interesting.
Okay. So you went straight into an ad agency straight after school?
I did, yeah, into the mailroom of an ad agency, right. Which for most people listening, wondering what the hell is a mailroom. A mailroom is literally where you would, mail would come in and would get sorted into the pigeonholes of all the staff. Mm. And my job was to deliver the mail.
So a job that is probably not in such great demand anymore.
No, I don't doubt it exists anymore.
Email room?
But it was this amazing ability to be able to go into the offices of people that I found interesting. So there was creatives there, there were suits, which is in account management, there was finance people, there were CEOs, and I would deliver their mail. Mm. And at the same time, I would just sit there and just have a chat with them. What are you doing?
So it was quite a strategic choice to go into advertising. You really thought about that even at the age of 17, 18?
If anything, I think it was a decision to not go to university. So I actually don't think it was advertising or marketing. I just think it was, I know what I didn't want. And I saw marketing and advertising as a world that I wanted to just understand.
Well, it represented creativity on a very simple level, didn't it? The advertising world. It was sort of in a boom time, you know. I guess you're talking about late 90s, early 2000s.
It was, yeah, 1999. So I finished school in 98, straight in the mailroom in 99. It was the end of that big boom of advertising, the time when budgets were big, hedonism was big.
A lot of it was on linear TV, which is starting to decline. And so much of this is changing, isn't it?
Yeah. I remember at the time it was all about, the entire ad agency was built around television commercials.
Yes.
So it was all around what's the script for a TV commercial? What's the budget? Where do we shoot it? Mm. And that was fascinating. It was the end of that era. At the same time, it was the start then of digital. So it was around the 2000s. So internet was starting to come, but digital was kind of, you know, this department that existed off to the side that got no budget, no one cared about. All they cared about was big television commercials.
Yeah. Okay. So you get into advertising. How long before you sort of really start to think about doing your own thing?
Yeah. So I was in advertising for a few years and I loved it. I realized I'd love creativity. Mm. I loved being around creative people. But a few years into that, I started thinking, you know, as in my early 20s, kind of what next? So I did eventually go to university, studied uni part-time whilst working full-time, which was the sort of things that you do in your 20s when you don't realise that you need sleep and you don't realise. And that was an interesting time. And then around that time, I also discovered I loved writing. So kind of creativity, you know, advertising and marketing is one creative outlet. But for me, at the time, I started going out to a lot of bars and a lot of festivals, and I started writing for the street press magazines that existed at the time, 3D World, Drum Media. Okay. And I just loved that world. I loved kind of being able to take something that should be really hard to describe, like listening to an album, the experience of going to a concert, and trying to, I would write thousands and thousands of words in order to write a 50-word review.
Right.
That was kind of my aim at the time, was write a 50-word review. And I would write thousands and thousands of words, and I'd listen to an album, and I would learn then just this skill of simplifying. It was a really amazing skill.
Injecting more and more power into the words that you end up with.
Yeah, just cutting. Yep. I mean, I also was a slightly naive 20-something-year-old who would write thousands of words in order to do a 50-word review. I now know in order to write a 50-word review, I just need to write 50 words.
But you've got a process in your mind now about how to get there.
Yeah, the process of kind of editing down and down and down. And so that was journalism all of a sudden started to interest me. And I was lucky, I was at university, I was at UTS studying Bachelor of Business, and realised halfway through it that I kind of hated business. So then pivoted and did majors in public communications and journalism at the time, because that was kind of my last few years. I wanted to study something I actually cared about as opposed to something I'd started.
Okay. And so this then bit by bit leads to Junkie Media?
Yeah. So then a few years of doing that, I started putting events on. Which was something fun that I used to do, and particularly in the gay community. So I came out as gay at about 20 or 21, and I started putting on events for my friends, first taste of kind of building a community around what I loved doing, and started putting on events and started selling tickets to my events. And around this time, I started selling tickets on a website called In The Mix, which has existed, and I became really good friends with the people that started In The Mix. And there was three. There was Neil, Andre, and Libby.
And In The Mix was ticketing and kind of cultural reviews, basically, like the stuff you were writing.
Yeah, In The Mix was one of the seminal community websites in Australia. So it was a dance music website, started around the year 2000, and it was all about bringing together a community of people who loved electronic music and having forums and news and photos and tickets. So I used to go to their little tiny office they had on Oxford Street and just sit there, and I was in my 20s, had nothing much to do, talk shit to them all day around what's going on and how does this work. And around that time, one of the original founders of In The Mix, Neil, said to me, does anything like In The Mix exist for the gay community? And I was like, no, it doesn't, but wouldn't it be amazing if something did? And so that was when the first website that I joined the three founders of In The Mix, and we launched samesame.com.au, which at the time was Australia's leading gay and lesbian community website. So it was all about taking the things that I had done in print. So I used to work for 3D World and Drum Media, and there was street press was still quite large in the gay community at the time, and putting all of that online around the time when online just started taking over people's lives.
And did it blow up?
Yeah, it was 2005, 2006, so the internet was new, and that then just got me into community, it got me into online journalism, and within that company then had many, many facets. So the two of the original founders left, and it was just Neil and I, and then in 2013 we decided that we needed to do something to save our company, because the company was focused at the time primarily on music journalism, and music journalism is a hard road to make a full business out of. So we launched Junkie in 2013, originally Junkie was about pop culture junkie. So Junkie was designed to be news and movies and TV. And 6 months after we launched, Tony Abbott got elected Prime Minister of Australia. We started publishing some political stories, and all of a sudden we realised that there was this entire space that wasn't being catered for young Australians, which was how can we do news and opinion with real bite? And we have Tony Abbott to thank for the rise of Junkie. Wow.
So that was at the time that I was actually taking over the hack program.
It was 2013 when we started.
Yeah. And so I remember interviewing Tony Abbott the night before he won that election. And then, 2014, which was full of broken election promises in this really, really tough budget, which essentially was the beginning of the end for him. Mm. But we were also trying to do the same thing with Hack at that time. How do we take this from a radio show to a much bigger multimedia brand, but without doing the opinion so much because we were at the national broadcaster? So there was a lot of rethinking and exploration going on at that time.
There was. It was one of the most fascinating times of media worldwide. Mm. I think in Australia, we had this microcosm of a conservative government and a lot of young Australians who got awoken by... awoken? Is that where woke come to? Yeah. Awoken.
Well, it is past tense. In a very different context.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you. A lot of young people who got awoken by the fact that this conservative government didn't represent who they were.
Well, yeah. I mean, Kevin Rudd had sort of turfed out John Howard on a similar wave, but it needs to come for each generation for them to have their moment to work out what pisses them off and when to engage or why they should engage.
And Tony Abbott really pissed a lot of young people in particular off. Mm. And what we did at Junkie was able to kind of harness some of that anger.
Mm.
And then at the same time, internationally, we had the rise of Facebook as a platform. So 2013, 2014, 2015 was when Facebook really amplified new voices, increased video production, and was able to allow a bunch of brands worldwide. So there was Junkie in Australia, Pedestrian in Australia, Vice in the US, BuzzFeed in the US. Mm. All these brands really grew from 2013 to 2015.
And lots of them are gone.
Yeah.
And we'll get to the other end of that curve later on. Interesting you were saying, or straight up acknowledging that it was a bit about outrage, because that was a new cultural phenomenon then as well, which we, and especially as someone who was sort of newly becoming sort of a public figure, you sort of felt it because people would outrage at you as well as politicians. So it was also a very intense and sometimes angry time online.
It really was. And I think I remember there was times at Junkie when we pushed that outrage to its limit and then had to pull it back. There was times when we had to protect our staff from the outrage on the internet, particularly female staff. There was times when I think the entire internet was pushing boundaries and kind of seeing where that outrage went. Some of it was healthy, some of it was really unhealthy.
Yeah.
But it certainly was a time when, because of social platforms, outrage got clicks.
Yeah. Still does.
Yeah. Then the concept of clickbait and the concept of all these things.
Listicles, remember those?
Listicles.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, totally.
You probably paid for your house with some of those. So what about the business model at that stage? Because we're going to get to this when we talk about what's happening with Meta and news at the moment. Was the business model and social media's part in it, was it about getting attention on social media and bringing people back to your website and selling banner ads, basically?
The business model evolved 5 or 6 times over 15 years, which is fascinating. I think that's one thing about anyone who works in digital media and independent publishing, has to ride these waves of external forces affecting your business model.
Mm.
So it started off, the website was all about desktop, and then it was about ads on a desktop, and then it was about mobile, and then it was about ads on a mobile. And as
within your website?
Within the website. Yeah. So driving someone to the website, selling ads around the content, and then trying to make money off that.
Yep.
And to various degrees that was successful. Then
how big a team could you sustain with that model? How many people did you have when you were running that model?
Yes, at Junkie's peak, we had about 60 or 70 full-time staff.
Wow.
So it was a big, large, scary, exciting, stressful,
expensive,
thrilling time. And it was wonderful. It was a really amazing time to look back at. Harder to think about maintaining that size of a business today. And so part of the reason that we did that, part of the way that we did that, was we had two different revenue models. The first one was the website. So that was where people would come to Junkie. We launched other titles. We had Punky, which was for younger Australians. We had AWOL, which is a travel title. We had a bunch of other websites. People would come there and we'd sell advertising around that.
And some of those were in big partnerships, like AWOL was tied with Qantas?
With Qantas, yeah. Okay. That was a long-term partnership with Qantas.
And so that's a slightly different business model to ads to multiple parties?
Yeah, so that's the junkie media side is one side. And then we had a thing we called Junkie Studio, which was essentially our creative and content agency. So this was a chance for me to relive the things that I'd learnt in my early 20s in those ad agencies. Mm. We built our own agency. And Junkie Studio, we created content for brands, white label content, which means that people don't know that we created it. So for a time, we created all the content for Netflix in Australia and New Zealand on their social channels.
Right.
So if you go to Netflix's page, that content was created by Junkie. We did the same for American Express, for Westpac, for Qantas. So all these kind of big brands that had trouble communicating with either young Australians or communicating on social, we said, we know how to speak to people. Mm. Every piece of content we publish is an experiment on what the algorithm's doing, how to get people's attention.
Real-time feedback.
Real-time feedback.
Which old media didn't really get. They get TV and radio ratings, which were, you know, very imprecise. They come out every few months, very different from the information you now get when you put something on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really fascinating and it gave us this real edge over other agencies because we had this proof point of Junkie. And it wasn't just our model. We borrowed it from the New York Times, had a thing called T-Lab. Guardian had Guardian Lab. New York Times had T-Studio. Vice had an agency called Virtue. Mm. So it was a great model at the time.
So how much revenue was coming from Junkie Studios versus Junkie the publisher?
It was about 50-50.
Right.
So Junkie Media couldn't exist without Junkie Studio because that's where we made our money. But Junkie Studio also couldn't exist without Junkie Media because that gave us our shop front.
Mm.
So it was a wonderful symbiotic relationship between the two businesses. And for me, as a creative person, it allowed me both to have a say in the editorial side, which I always found fascinating, but also the creative and marketing side, which was something that I had wanted to do since I was in my early 20s.
So of that Junkie journey, what was the hardest point?
We almost lost the business at one stage.
When?
It was relatively late in the journey. So Junkie had launched, AWOL had launched with Qantas. So it must have been about 2014.
Okay, so you're only really a year into fully-fledged Junkie at this point.
Yeah, and Junkie was at its peak of rising. Mm. It had all this hype around it. It had a lot of attention on it. We were getting a lot of money and advertisers. We were doing big deals with brands like Qantas. And we had an internal issue where one of our people who worked in finance didn't pay our tax bills.
Okay.
And didn't tell us. He wasn't paying our tax bills. And then left the company. And we didn't realise this until one day I checked the bank account in the morning and there was something like $60,000 less in there. And I was like, what is this? And it said ATO, $60,000. Mm. And like, I hadn't paid a bill for $60,000. So I called up the ATO and they said, we've done a garnishee order. Mm. And a garnishee order is if you don't pay your tax bills, the ATO can go into your bank account. If you have the money there, just take it.
Mm.
That's one of the things they can do. I'd never heard of a garnishee order.
And no one does until it's too late.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It turns out that we hadn't paid our tax bills for a very long period of time. We had not realised this. We assumed our finance people were doing it. And we had $1 million-plus bill to the tax department.
Wow.
So we then, we had a board, we had a company, we had all these things. We had to have serious meetings around trading insolvency. Are we trading solvent? Are we trading insolvent? We had a few weeks to come up with $1 million plus or we would be trading insolvent.
Where'd you get it?
It was hectic. We also had meetings with administrators around what would it look like if you went to administration.
Mm.
And those meetings, that's the low light of my career because you sit in these meetings and someone tells you what's going to happen and all you can think about is your reputation, your money, your staff, your contracts, everything that could happen.
Oh my goodness. Right as the thing is in its, like the prime of its growth phase.
To the front of the audience, it was this rising star. And behind, we had this issue, which was we weren't aware of it. And all of a sudden, we had a few weeks to solve it. So the way that we had to solve it is we had to go back to existing shareholders. I think we were probably losing money at the time because we were in a growth phase, either breaking even or losing money. We had to go back to existing shareholders and try to
sell the dream, right?
Sell the dream.
To go in deeper.
Hey, you know this business that's not making any money. You should put more money into it.
Mm. Because we had a shit accountant.
Yeah, because we took our after ball. So yeah. I don't blame...
We're great managers, though. We really understand the digital market. We're trying to skill up on accounting and just to nail a few of those important things.
I put the blame on us, as in it's our, my job as directors there and at the board to keep an eye on that. So that's... that's completely the blame. So we then had to find $1 million+ in 2 weeks or the business is going to go under and everything's going to go with it. Mm. We did. We found the money. I borrowed money off my parents and anyone that I could find to put money into the business. My business partner borrowed money off his family. Some of our investors put money in. The terms were horrible, but it was this moment of we could lose this if we don't keep our eye on this ball. And so that was a real big, terrible moment. But I've learnt more in that moment, in that stress, in those, not being able to sleep, not being able to eat, trying to go through all that whilst our staff were unaware of what's going on.
Mm. So 2016, you sell it. So we're only talking about 3 years later from being in $1 million debt in the growth phase to selling it. It was reportedly sold for $10 million. Is that accurate?
It was 85% was sold for $11.5 million, something like that.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, something like that.
So pretty amazing turnaround.
Yeah, because it was not the structure. There's no structural problem with the business. That was a real short-term issue that we needed to deal with. And we dealt with it. And it was then a good business. And I'm very thankful that the people that were able to put in money at the time were able to be repaid and that it was not a business problem. That was an internal problem, not an external problem.
To get to that point of selling it for, over $11 million, like that's incredible. So what happened? What was really successful after you hit that crisis point?
Once we got through that, we started realizing we can kind of get through anything.
Mm.
I think we had a lot of confidence. The business was doing really well. Junkie was a great business. We launched Punky off the back of that, which was the youth version of Junkie, I suppose a Gen Z version of Junkie. We just had a lot more confidence in the business and we continued to ride the wave.
Well, speaking of the wave, the environment you were in was an explosion in social media. Facebook was very strong at that point. Instagram was rising. And speaking of political targets for young people, there was a rise in right-wing political leaders like Donald Trump and the Brexit campaigners. So there was a lot of tension and anger in the world. You're selling the business in 2016. It's right as Donald Trump is coming to power. So for a younger generation who generally lean more progressive, this was a time to be fired up and online.
It was. And do you know how I remember the day that we sold the business? It was the day that the UK voted to Brexit.
Wow.
To leave the, I remember that. So it was in June or July. I think it was June 2016. So it was just a few months before Donald Trump got elected. It was Brexit happened. So there was a lot happening globally.
Part of the reason I wanted our listeners to understand your story is that I think, if you don't mind me saying, I think the book that you've just released, Work Backwards, has a lot of idealism that I think might only come if you put yourself into a good position where you felt comfortable and could reflect and almost afford to be idealistic. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. This is the third book I've written, and I feel like the first two were leading up to this, both in terms of confidence, in terms of idealism, and in terms of I think it's time that we have a conversation as a country about how we work.
Mm.
I think the way that we're working is really unhealthy. And I'm an optimist by nature. I do look for the idealistic version of things. And Work Backwards for me is a bit of a manifesto to this is a way that we can work. It can exist. Work doesn't have to be dreary or monotonous or purposeless or hard.
I mean, probably one little nugget that sums up the whole book is that we talk about work-life balance. And you point out, well, we've put things in the wrong order right from the start. If we're talking about work-life balance, should be life-work balance, or we need to actually break this up into more than two parts. It needs to be four parts. It's life, relationships, health, money, work, and you put those into four quarters, and that's much more of a realistic picture of how we should be looking at our lives that include a quarter of work.
Yeah, I think the work-life balance is a... it's just one of those terms that is so overused. People think of it as though this balance kind of thing between work and life, and I have several thoughts on it. The first is, as you mentioned, life and work are in the wrong order.
Mm.
We say work-life balance. It should be life-work balance.
Mm.
And just by making that simple change, we're reordering and reprioritizing where life should be. It should be a life-work balance. And the second part then is, if you think about what life is, there's so many parts to it, and this is where it's, you can get philosophical, you can get idealized. But if you break it down, there's mind, body, relationships, and work. And they're the four things. So if we think of, it's not as catchy to say life, body, relationship, work, balance, but that's really what it should be. And I think that when we talk about it, the simplest way of doing that is, I think we should kill the term work-life balance and only call it life-work balance.
Mm. Life-work balance, yeah. Well, that's a good start.
Yeah.
And then you set out this model in the book for starting by looking at the life you want to live, then asking how much money you need to live it, and then working out where work fits into that. A few challenges to that. One is that often if you're on the breadline, you know, you haven't sold a multi-million dollar company and you're struggling to get by and you're not sure what your career options are, survival instinct dictates that you actually have to put the work instinct first. Is there any other way around that?
Yeah, and I acknowledge this book comes from a place of privilege. So I acknowledge my own privilege in this. I don't have kids.
Yep.
I've sold several businesses. However, I spoke to dozens and dozens of people around the world.
Mm.
Some people who were wealthy and could do what they wanted, and other people who just had to work. And I think that all of us, no matter where work fits in your life and no matter how much you earn from it, there's some really simple, basic things that you can do just to make each day better. And I don't think that this book is not meant to be a model of everyone should build up a business and sell a business and then go live in Mallorca. That's not necessarily what this book is about.
Yeah.
It's about if you can just make some small changes to the way that you're working, even if work is just a paycheck for you. If you can figure out, there's one idea in this book called job crafting, which is around just changing slightly some things about your work. It could be to do with tasks, the relationships with people that you have, or cognitive way that you think about work. If you change that a tiny bit, you can make work so much better for you. So I think this book is an idealized version of where you can get to
if you want to re-engineer the whole thing. Yeah.
But sometimes it might just be like one little small thing, and that is enough for somebody.
Okay, that's a very good answer to my questions. Let's just dig a bit deeper into that idea there of job crafting. You're essentially talking about the things you can dial up or down depending on your personality, whether you're introverted, extroverted, whether you like strategic thinking or more tactical thinking or process-driven work. Are they the sorts of things that you can sort of, I guess, reflect on personally as to who you are and what you enjoy, and then just tweak the tasks within your job around that?
Yeah, job crafting is one of the simplest and easiest tools that anyone can use in order to make their job just a tiny bit better. And it started with two researchers in 2001, Amy Wieriznecki and Jane Dutton. And they started looking at job descriptions. So job descriptions is something that most of us get when we start a new job. If we've ever been a manager, we've written a job description and you might get it in your job application, or you might get it the first day you arrive. You look at it, you read it, goes in the drawer, you never look at it ever again. And what they found was that most people naturally took that job description and started dialing up and down things that they liked, things that gave them meaning, things that made them feel better. So they turned that into this area of research called job crafting. And it looks at three areas: tasks, relationships, and cognitive. And within each of those areas, it's how can you do a little bit more of something that you like doing? So tasks, what tasks do you actually like doing? Do more of those, you'll feel better. Do less the ones that you don't like, you'll feel better.
Okay.
Relationships, who do you like spending time with? Same concept. And then cognitive, how can you sometimes rethink your job, just your approach to it, to make you feel better about it? And if,
can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. So an example of that is maybe someone who works at the reception of a radio station.
Okay.
And potentially their job, they could think of it in one way, which is like, oh, my job is just to answer phones and to send emails and to do all of the tasks that no one else wants to do. That's one way, hypothetically, you could think about it.
Possibly accurate.
But a cognitive way of reframing that is just slightly thinking about it differently and thinking, my job is to welcome people when they arrive, make them feel comfortable, make sure the staff here have a good day. And as soon as you cognitively think differently about your job.
I am the skin on this body. I'm the first line of contact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think anyone can look at a job that they do and just slightly think differently about it.
Reframe it.
Yeah, if you reframe it in a positive way, that can have a huge impact on the meaning that you get from work and how you feel about your job.
The other challenge that kept coming to my mind as I read your book was that a lot of your examples of people, I guess, embracing these ideas and changing their careers were stories of people who quit a 9-to-5 job and started doing their own thing. So there's an example of a young woman that becomes a TikTok, Microsoft Excel wizard and starts making lots of money by doing all these tutorials online. There's another story of a woman starts a dog walking business. A lot of them do sort of fit this mold of going independent, embracing the digital world, a lot of digital nomads in your book. And, you know, you've been one at different times, a very high functioning one. But there's so much structure, security and longevity that comes with working for a big organization. And so, you know, especially the digital examples, and you know this as well as anyone, it can be a real flash in the pan. You can be going viral for a brief time or a medium amount of time, but not probably forever. And so do you feel like you were steering people in a direction potentially that's a little bit too short term by choosing those examples?
Yeah, I wanted to inspire people with a real breadth of examples.
Mm.
And so some of them are TikTok stars like Miss XL, but some of them also are two people who own a bakery in Glasgow or an ironworker in Western Virginia. And that breadth, I think, is what I was aiming for.
That's in the type of work and the type of industry. But what about, did you have much breadth in the model? Because they all seem to be very independent sort of businesses.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of businesses I wanted to show in order to expand people's mind about what was possible. And I intentionally went big with here's some big things you could do. And then the final third of the book is quite practical. Yeah. So the final third of the book is around, okay, let's now, you've been inspired by Miss XL who quit her job to make TikToks.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about what you can actually do. And within that, there's things like how to have better meetings at work, how to be better at taking time off, how to talk to your boss about hybrid working or flexible working or remote working or a 4-day work week. So I think the intention was to inspire people and to think big and then, okay, I'm inspired now. How can I actually do this?
Mm.
And then the end, it's here's some practical ways. So you want to have actually better meetings at work. And that's different from quitting your job and becoming a TikTok star.
Mm. Okay, let's bring the two big threads together. So we've talked about your career story in digital publishing and we've talked about other people's careers and how to get the most out of them. And I think the topic that brings this together is what's happening with Meta and news at the moment. You know, Facebook, Instagram, they've said that they're not going to pay money to news organizations to provide content on their platforms. It's sent a shockwave through the industry because they have been putting in tens of millions of dollars into the Australian media industry over the last few years since the agreements were struck, and they're not going to do that anymore. So how are you seeing that? You're now the chairperson of the Digital Publishers Alliance, which is supporting people working in this space. How damaging is Facebook or Meta's decision here?
Yeah, I think their decision has the potential to be devastating to small and independent publishers. So after leaving Junkee, one of the things I did was set up a group called the Digital Publishers Alliance. And so we're a group of, there's 50 plus independent publishers. So most of the independent digital publishers you can think of in the country. And it's an industry body that didn't exist up until this point. So my whole time that we were building Junkee and Same and all those things, we were very much working in silos. And now we have an industry body, which I'm very proud to chair. And we have come together for moments like this. the moments to be able to stand up to Meta and say, what you are doing will be devastating. Do you understand the impact that you could potentially have?
But what are you appealing to there? Like their feelings? I mean, their morality? Because this is a business, right? And when you started Junkie, you used Facebook to bring eyeballs to your websites to sell advertising. And that was the way the model worked. Mm-hmm. And so the argument from these big social media platforms is that we've helped you build your own businesses rather than us being your business.
Yeah, I think we have a massive symbiotic relationships with these digital platforms where money flows both ways. Digital publishers pay Meta, Meta funds journalism sometimes. And that is the way that it has operated for the last 10, 15 years. Mm. So it's been a real symbiotic relationship. And Meta is breaking up with the news industry. And they're breaking up basically overnight. And that is the main issue of trying to wean a lot of these businesses who have been trying to wean off Instagram and Facebook for years takes time.
Mm.
And so our appeal is not really to Meta. We understand they're a big global trillion-dollar company that have the right to choose what areas they want to go into and what not go into. But we don't believe they have the right to just turn something off overnight. So we're talking to the government. We have ongoing discussions with the government, with the ACCC, with Michelle Rowland's office, with Assistant Treasurer, to just make sure that everyone is aware of what the implications are. If Meta is designated under this code, the most likely outcome of that is that news will be banned in Australia for on social media, on Facebook and Instagram.
Are they really going to ban news? Because so far they're pulling the news tab, which no one has ever seen. I don't even know where it was. So like that doesn't sound like a big deal. Do you think they're really going to say stop a Daily Oz from publishing on their platforms?
Yes, that's what they've done in Canada.
So they've completely stopped people from posting about news, because news is kind of hard to define. I mean, I could be posting news about something going on in my personal life. That wouldn't get banned.
In Canada, they've had a very similar fight with the government there, and they've completely banned any news on Facebook and Instagram. So even Australian titles, so Daily Oz and a bunch of other titles, you cannot view them in Canada at the moment.
Really? So like the ABC even?
ABC.
Couldn't publish on Facebook or Instagram at all?
At all. Completely stopped.
Their accounts disabled.
So the account will still exist. You just can't post anything to it and you can't see anything on there. So if someone goes to the account, they see there's an ABC account, they see it has 500,000 followers and you can't see any of the content. It says, due to the Canadian government, you can't access this content.
Right.
So all news banned on Instagram and Facebook. And it's
okay.
It's horrible to think about a future in which not only how that affects businesses, so particularly smaller and independent publishers, because the big publishers will be okay. They're diversified enough. I'm not worried about Nine and News in this situation. But then I really worry about Australian consumers. I worry about anyone listening to this who gets their news consciously or unconsciously on social media.
Yeah, well, tie it back to the book, because you got, you know, young people who've studied journalism or, you know, other sort of creative or editorial kind of career paths who are navigating the space, being told probably by their parents and grandparents that, you know, there's not much future in it, but having hope that it will, seeing new platforms emerge, new entrepreneurs in publishing in the digital world, like you were, provide at one point 60 or 70 jobs. But then you see these big sort of pinch points where the industry seems to get strangled.
Yeah, and I think it shows the problem with identifying your work identity and your own identity too close together. So if you identify as, I'm this person, I have this job, if anything happens to that job, and look at the entire journalism industry and the space, what's going to happen there, you personally, if you don't have the right foundation, could easily be rocked. So that's what, when most people think about, and the whole concept of work backwards is most people tend to think of work first, then they get an income from that, and then they live their life off the back of that.
But if they lose their job, it ruins the whole model.
The whole thing collapses, including their own personal identity. So instead, one way, and this is an idealized way of dealing with this, is you need to flip that around and think about yourself first. So who you are without your job. The simplest way in the book, I love acronyms, and I have an acronym of MAP. So you need a map to know where to go. And a MAP stands for you need to know what meaning you get from work and outside work, what your anchors are, which is your core values, and what your priorities are.
Mm.
And if you know those things, doesn't matter what happens, doesn't matter what happens with your job, doesn't matter which industry you work in, you know that you've kind of built those right foundations, and then you can figure out the rest of your life and your work and money and everything else off the back of that. You just need to have a map, know where to go.
Great advice for someone wondering if their journalism job is going to last, but great advice for anyone.
You need a map, Tom.
I think that's a great place to leave it, Tim. Thanks so much for writing this book and offering your insights and channeling your privilege into helping other people work out their own careers and their own journeys, and really interesting to get what was a pretty scary insight into what's going to happen in the media this year. Tim, amazing to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekend Briefing.
Awesome. Thank you, Tom. Really enjoyed it.
That was Tim Duggan. His book is called Work Backwards. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the chat, we'd love you to share it on your socials. And also subscribe, rate and review The Briefing in the podcast app that you're listening to us on right now. Thank you very much.
Listener.